There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing.
On.
There is this thing going on.
What?
Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Welcome to the Friday edition of CKUT's community news program, Off the Hour. Today is November 19th. My name is Sarah Jesmer. CKUT broadcasts from the unceded traditional territory of the Anishinaabeg in the Gunyagihaga, one of the founding nations of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. It's 5 p.m. here on Jojage, which is also known as the Island of Montreal. Each week, in the last few months, we've been sharing the air with sounds from creators that we think that you might want to hear from, while CKUT's studios remain closed for health reasons, and our volunteer programmers continue to fill the air remotely. And we're going to do the same today. This hour, we're sharing the air with It's Going Down Radio. They're talking about the Coastal GasLink pipeline and Wet'suwet'en resistance to the pipeline project. Yesterday, Thursday, RCMP started arresting people who were physically on the Yinta, or Wet'suwet'en territory. Here's Molly Slato giving an update.
The RCMP are invading Wet'suwet'en territory once again. There have been approximately 15 arrests that have happened already at Gidimden checkpoint. Legal observers, media have been arrested. Two of our Wet'suwet'en elders have been arrested and removed from the territory. Right now we're at Coyote Camp and the RCMP are moving in to remove me from my territory. This invasion, once again, speaks to the genocide that's happening to Indigenous people that are trying to protect our water for our future generations. It's infuriating. It's illegal, even according to their own means of colonial law. We need to shut down Canada. Our Haudenosaunee relatives have been arrested, violently arrested. They've been removed from our territories. They're removing Wet'suwet'en people from our own lands. They're planning to drill under Wet'suwet'en and destroy our sacred headwaters. We need people to act. You need to act where you are now. Shut down major infrastructure. Do whatever you can. Rally against the investors. Shut down the investors to this project so that it is very clear that Indigenous people will not stand for the genocide that's happening to our lands and to our future generations.
It's Going Down Radio talked to Slato this week. We'll share the air with them till 6 p.m. If you want to hear more about this episode, if you want to hear more about its creators, or about what's going down in Wet'suwet'en territory, you can find all of their content on itsgoingdown.org. And as always, if you want to get in touch with CKUT, you can search for them on Facebook. Just put in CKUT. If you want to get in touch with this show, Off the Hour, Friday edition, you can email me at newsintern@ckut.ca. Again, that's news. intern@ckut.ca. Stay safe, Montreal. And rest in peace, Elsipi Puttigouk and Janai Dopwell Bailey.
Welcome to This Is America, November 16th, 2021. On this episode, we feature a special interview with Slato, spokesperson for the Gitemindin Checkpoint, about ongoing Indigenous resistance on Wet'suwet'en territory. We then switch to our discussion where we attack the recent neoliberal hot takes around the last round of elections. All this and more, but first, let's get to the news. On Wet'suwet'en territory, coastal GasLink personnel have been given an eviction notice and pushed out of the territory. Slato, the spokesperson for the Gitemindin Checkpoint, which controls access to the territory, said in a press release that Wet'suwet'en hereditary chiefs have never ceded, surrendered, or lost title to the territory, and that coastal GasLink employees that have been breached both Indigenous law and an eviction notice that was issued nearly 2 years ago. Check out our interview with Slato later in the episode for a deeper dive. In other news, a rail blockade was organized in solidarity with the ongoing Wet'suwet'en struggle, and solidarity demonstrations have also been called. White nationalist Groypers, led by Unite the Right marcher, Holocaust denier, and racist troll Nick Fuentes, attempted to hold several rallies in New York City over the weekend alongside other anti-vaccine conspiracy theory groups, but faced pushback from much of the right as well as resistance from everyday New Yorkers and anti-fascists. On November 10th, a small group of Groypers attempted to harass an immigrant rights rally, only to be confronted and run off by union construction workers. On Saturday night, the Groypers attempted to rally but were pushed off the streets by New Yorkers throwing objects and chanting the fascists down. This type of street organizing, combined with online pressure and public education, shows how anti-fascists can work to split the fascist wing of the anti-vax movement from its wider MAGA base. As the Daily Beast wrote, an anti-vax protest outside of Pfizer's New York City's headquarters imploded on Saturday afternoon as white nationalist anti-vaxxers showed up only to be publicly shunned by the local anti-vaxxer demonstrators against vaccine mandates. The war of words erupted as the New York locals attempted to distance themselves from the ultra-racist followers of white nationalist and Unite the Right attendee Nick Fuentes. Today's organizers completely disavow infiltrators and trolls attempting to link medical freedom with extremist ideologies, namely Nick Fuentes and VaxWatch, the local group posted to their own Telegram channel. The outright rebuke apparently left a sour taste in the young white nationalist's mouth because he quickly tried to sic his followers on the rival protesters. Hashtag let him fight. It should be noted that Fox News removed a mention of the white nationalists in article headline and its reporting after it got pushback from alt-right trolls associated with the Groypers online. Tenant union members who took over a vacant unit in their apartment building in so-called Toronto and turned it into a mutual aid hub celebrated the one-year anniversary of the project, with local school children organizing a canned food drive at their school in support. Students involved in the ongoing occupation at the HBU Blackburn University have declared victory after 34 days, with the university agreeing to meet their demands and to not retaliate against any student who had been arrested or involved in the ongoing occupation. And now for some upcoming events. On November 20th in Riverside, California, there is a Pushing Down the Walls event benefiting political prisoners. If you value what's going down as a revolutionary autonomous media resource in times of crisis and you have the means, please go to itsgoingdown.org/shop, sign up to donate monthly, give us a one-time donation, or donate through Bitcoin. Again, to support us, please go to itsgoingdown.org/shop. You can also tell a friend about us, sign up for our RSS feed, listen to us on the radio, follow us on social media, and also if you enjoy this show, check out other anarchist podcasts on the Channel Zero Anarchist Podcast Network. That's going to do it for us. Enjoy the interview and the discussion. We will see you soon.
This is Slato. I'm here on Cassia Yinta, Gitemindin clan of the Wet'suwet'en Nation, and we're behind the blockade on Gitemindin territory where Coastal GasLink plans to drill under Wet'suwet'en.
So maybe just to get us started, I think a lot of people have seen the recent arrests, and there's a lot of kind of moving pieces to everything. Can you just tell us, kind of give us an overview of everything that's happening right now?
Sure. So we've been here for 48 days now. We're on a main access road to the drill pad site. The access road is blocked so that Coastal GasLink can't come in and drill under our sacred headwaters. In the first few days of the occupation, there was a lot of police presence. There were two arrests that were made. The RCMP and CIRG, the Community Industry Response Group, specialized RCMP to deal with Indigenous land offenders, came in and was coming in almost daily into the camp and sabotaging things and being violent with people and threatening everybody with arrest. And so probably a couple of weeks after that, some friends and allies showed up and were able to chase the RCMP out of the territory. They hadn't tried to come back again until about a week ago, and they were escorted out of the area once again. And so we're able to hold the police presence from coming into the territory. They're patrolling on the main road and in other parts of the territory, but currently we're holding this space. It's been 48 days now, and with no police in camp at all. So things are going really well.
Can you tell us a little more about, you said there's a special unit within the RCMP that's developed just to deal with Indigenous land defense struggles. Our understanding is that this is the same police unit that was also at the ongoing resistance at Ferry Creek against the logging there. Is that true?
Yes, that's true. Yeah, so this detachment or this unit of the RCMP has actually been the one that created detachment on our territory after 2019. And so they have a detachment on Gidimden territory that they had been operating out of and had full-time 24-hour staff patrolling and harassing and surveilling people for about a year and a half. And then once the Ferry Creek blockade happened and that resistance started heating up, a lot of the CIRG were called to that action. And so they've had a limited presence in our territory since that time. And so it seems like now there's this divide where they can't be in two places at once, and they don't have enough officers to enforce both struggles at the same time. And so a lot of the CIRG are still down at Ferry Creek.
We've seen online that they have built a man camp on the territory. Can you talk about that and also how people are dealing with that construction?
Yeah, so there's actually three man camps, or four man camps on Wet'suwet'en territory. There's two that are up past Cassia territory, and so they're not on Gidimden territory. They're way back in the territories, close to the mountain ranges, where they're trying to blast through the mountain to get over to Kitimat, to the coast. There's another man camp over on one of the other Gidimden territories near us, neighboring us. And there's another one in Burns Lake. So some of them are fully operational with, you know, several hundred people, employer. It's been really intense with all the conflicts happening. Some of the CGL workers are getting licked and becoming very, so things have been heating up a little bit in this area. And they've actually been blocking the roads themselves with their heavy machinery in order to Wet'suwet'en people out of the territory.
What do you see as the next moves? Like, what do you see happening in the coming weeks?
Well, we're going to continue to hold our ground here. And I think for people to know that the eviction order that happened by the hereditary chiefs in January of 2020, on January 4th, the hereditary chiefs evicted all Coastal GasLink from the territory. All of the letter and were in attendance and evicted them off of the territory. An order still stands and is being enforced by the Wet'suwet'en. So that's a really important thing that people should know and understand, that just because, you know, things have been quiet for the last year because of COVID, that eviction still needs to be upheld, and that eviction needs to be enforced by Wet'suwet'en people on the ground. And it will continue to be enforced.
Do you feel that the intense amount of resistance that happened the last couple of years, you know, across Canada, you know, I mean, there was lots of articles written just talking about the massive impact to the so-called Canadian economy. Do you feel like that drastically changed the way that the state is sort of dealing with this thing, or did that make them change their tactics a lot, or...
Yeah, I think absolutely. You know, those actions and how widespread they were and how effective they were at crippling the Canadian economy, I think is a real threat to the state. And so they're calculating every move that they make. Coastal GasLink can't afford to have another big conflict in terms of their investors and their timelines and their budgets and all those kinds of things. But also, the government can't afford to have another shutdown Canada. And that's exactly what's going to happen if RCMP try to come in here and remove Wet'suwet'en people from their land again at gunpoint.
From people that are just kind of like watching this play out online, the brutality of the police seems very clear, especially like when we also see other like land defense struggles, how they're being repressed. I'm just curious though, on the other end, and you know, the Canadian state seems to be kind of like Trudeau is very known for like, you know, trying to speak to concerns and kind of like recuperate all these things in a very neoliberal way. I'm just curious, is that another aspect of how the state is trying to address this, trying to like appease certain people and go about it in like a softer way while the police are also being very brutal at the same time?
Yeah, I mean, I think that definitely, you know, anybody who's following along, and we obviously can see very clearly that Trudeau and all the levels of government are, you know, they're paying huge lip service to reconciliation and to Indigenous rights and to the rule of law and all of those kinds of things. But on the ground, we know that none of that applies here. It doesn't apply to Indigenous people. It doesn't apply to Wet'suwet'en people or anybody trying to defend the land or anybody supporting those who are trying to defend the land. And so it's very clear that they are not following their own rule of law. We uphold Wet'suwet'en law, and all of our guests on our territory uphold Wet'suwet'en law. But we know and can see right through Justin Trudeau's lip service of, you know, Indigenous rights and Indigenous respecting Indigenous people, because RCMP are coming in and brutalizing people and have used tasers and have used torture just within the last 48 days here on Wet'suwet'en territory.
I'm curious if you have any thoughts or messages for folks that may be facing certain charges. I know both in the so-called United States and in Canada, there are people that are facing pretty heavy charges stemming from the last couple of years of solidarity actions. I'm just wondering if you have anything that you'd want to express to them.
Yeah, I mean, I think first and foremost, I want to express my gratitude for everybody who is standing up against the state. I mean, I think that all of our struggles and our worldviews and our values are similar, whether it's Indigenous sovereignty or the repression of the state, the colonial state, capitalism, and all of the fallout of all of those things. You know, I think that they're all really connected, and that people have replied to that call to action to take an active and aggressive approach to challenging the state in the way that they're behaving and the way that they're treating Indigenous people and the environment. And so I have the deepest and utmost respect for everybody who has sacrificed and everybody who's continuing to sacrifice, you know, their freedom, their livelihoods, their families, to be on the front lines and to support us in this struggle. And I think that, you know, the state is coming down really hard on people because it's a real threat. We're a real threat when we act together and we act in solidarity with each other. When we shut down Canada in the way that we did, that's a real threat to the state, and they know it, so that they're trying to repress people even further. And I think that when those kinds of situations happen and when those opportunities arise, that we have to, it's an opportunity and a call to us to push even harder because we know we're making a difference.
Well, just kind of like one other big overarching question. I'm sure you saw this, but there was recently an article that was published that talked about just the massive impact that Indigenous land defense struggles are having on the fossil fuel industry. And, you know, with the COP26 recently happening, and there's still a lot of hope, it seems like, within certain movements around different governments and corporations, you know, kind of reining in the fossil fuel industry, and you all have just been on the front lines and had such a massive impact on fighting back against all of these pipeline projects. I'm curious, you know, what you would say maybe to other people that are still having hope in the governments and the corporations themselves being able to regulate their own industries and actions.
I mean, I think that the work that people are doing is important in all different areas. I do believe that direct action and occupation are what force those corporations and the governments to take action. I don't believe that they're going to do it based on the fact that it's the right thing to do. I think that the action that people are taking on the ground is what's forcing the hand. And we need to continue to do that. And we need to be creative and do it in new ways and push the envelope even further than we already have, because we're on the right track. We're winning this fight, and we just have to push harder and keep going and keep, you know, making those relationships and those bonds with different groups and different accomplices, and make sure that we're all united in this fight.
Well, for those that are listening and want to support, what are some ways that people can both keep up with what's going on and also take action and solidarity or offer material support?
So we have a website, yintaaccess.com, and that has all of our social media handles and all of our videos and our updates that people can follow along. I encourage people to, first and foremost, come to the Yinta, to come here if they can, to be a part of this, you know, time in our history that real change is happening, and that we have this amazing opportunity to see significant change and to take the action that has been, you know, it has been brewing for years, for generations. I think that now is the time that Indigenous folks and other folks and other groups and organizations of groups that can come together and really make a significant difference. And so I'm calling on everybody to come to the Yinta and see for themselves exactly what we're fighting for and exactly how we operate and exactly what we can do together. If people can't come, I encourage people to take action where they are. There's been some amazing, amazing solidarity actions all across so-called Canada and so-called the United States and around the world that have been, you know, we've been watching and we've been seeing how people are operating, and it's absolutely inspiring. And so I encourage more of that to happen. I don't think that we should wait until there's a big raid in Wet'suwet'en territory again. We need to take advantage of the fact that we are winning now, and we got to push it as far as we can right now.
Anything else you'd like to say?
I think that there's a huge opportunity here that has been, you know, we've seen it happening, you know, this relationship and this allyship between Indigenous warriors and anarchists that has been developing over the years. And I think that combining those two groups, particularly is a really powerful move against the state and a really powerful voice that we can have together. And so I just want to encourage people to act on that and encourage people to think about that and how we can make huge differences, acting together and doing direct action as a collective and in solidarity with one another.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Dog, you can see rainy weather, and the only way we gon' make it out is if we stick together. Black lives matter, dog. You can see rainy weather, and the only way we gon' make it out is if we stick together. They tryna get rid of my people, they treating us like we ain't equal. My fingers out here moving lethal. I feel like I'm Stevie Wonder, niggas see through. Niggas ain't watching your moves, wanna be you. Dirty, he play with the keys like the Beatles. We making scenes just wait for the next sequel. The police they killing the black, we ain't equal. And they kill Rex for what? They ain't even had no reason. Martin Luther King had a dream to get us all on one mission. And ever since way back then, we've been on one mission. Malcolm X had sticks out, he was on a mission. And for George Floyd, we all went to war. Cause they ain't had no reason. They ain't tried to treat us like slaves. They don't got no reason. We ain't going out like that. Back then, we ain't have shoes on our clothes on our back. Back then, ain't have a bed, we had to sleep on the mat. Back then, we had it the worst way. Back then, had it the worst way. Back then, they was treating us like we were slaves. Back then, they was treating us like we were slaves. Dog, you can see rainy weather. And the only way we gon' make it out is if we stick together. Black lives matter. Dog, you can see rainy weather. And the only way we gon' make it out is if we stick together.
Okay, we're here to discuss the news once again. There's been a wave of elections, supposedly. We're going to comment on those. We're going to break them apart, dissect them, talk about them, and also, moreover, talk about what people are inferring from them. You know, every time there's an election and the Republicans get in, there's always this discussion about what does it mean for the left? What does it mean for either groups that are promoting electoralism, or what does it mean for the country in general? So far, what we've seen a lot of is that this is a referendum on Biden, or that it's a referendum on progressive wing of the Democratic Party, supposedly, or this obsession within the Democrats, supposedly, with identity politics. I mean, we could take that in a variety of ways, post-George Floyd. And the Democrats need to return to some sort of, like, bread and butter rush back to the center, supposedly, instead of these crazy, far out there, far left ideas. We're going to kind of attack all of those positions and look at what's really going on. But real quick, you know, what happened this week?
Yeah, so there was this big question going into these kind of off-year elections, right? So, I mean, probably most of you didn't even know that there was an election happening where you live. If you don't live in a big city, right? In big cities, these kinds of elections are, you know, often for things like mayor, city council, right? So they tend to get some play. And there were kind of two things that were going on here. First is there were a number of cities, Seattle, Minneapolis, Cleveland, a few others that had sort of usually charter amendments to the city charter, sometimes just kind of legal proposals that were getting voted on under referendum, to either significantly change the way that accountability happens for police, or to create a process for cutting police funding, or both. Now, in a lot of those cases, in fact, in every single case, I think, except Cleveland, all of those bills lost. Cleveland won in that election, right? But that was kind of one of these big questions, is like, how far were voters going to go around the defund the police question? And I can talk about why those bills failing in a place like Minneapolis doesn't necessarily mean what people are taking away from it, but we can get to that in a second. The other thing that happened was that there were a number of these kind of high-profile, highly politicized elections, right? a couple of governorships, specifically Virginia and New Jersey. Lots of like local school board elections that got all wrapped up in this like, you know, literal fantasy about critical race theory, things like this. Right. And so a lot of people were looking at this and kind of seeing it as an indication or a bellwether of sort of where we are at the moment, sort of a year ish into the Biden administration.
So what are the hot takes that we're hearing right now from folks?
Yeah.
You know, what is the spectacle really saying about these elections, and what are they kind of like, what advance with these talking points?
Yeah, so I think first thing I want to do is I want to break these out. I want to talk about the question about the police, and then the bigger, broader sort of like, this is where political dynamics are and what people are saying about that. Because on some level, they're different questions. On some level, they're the same question, or at least the pundits are treating it as the same question, right? So on this local level, again, all of these referendums failed except the one in Cleveland, I think all of them. And most progressive candidates lost their mayoral elections, again, except for Cleveland, right? And so there was this, there's kind of this take out in the media right now that, you know, the movement against the police failed and all of these voters turned up to reject the defund the police agenda and blah, 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 blah. And it's true. In a lot of cities, moderate candidates, even moderate candidates of the same party as their opponent, were using Republican talking points. And they were saying, this person wants to defund the police, blah, 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 right? Now, there's a number of things to keep in mind here, though, that are really important. First is we have to take into account local political dynamics. So let's take Buffalo as an example. Buffalo is kind of one of these cities that's being held up as an example of the left losing, right? Because in the primaries, this DSA member, I'm forgetting her name off the top of my head, was able to win the Democratic Party primary. And in the process, sort of potentially unseat a mayor, which has been in power for, I think, like 12 years or something like that. And this mayor is a very moderate Democrat. Now, that mayor then ran a write-in campaign and won pretty handily, actually, by a wide, significant margin. And everyone's looking at that and saying, oh, well, that's a rejection of the DSA's like left-wing politics. But we have to keep a lot of things in mind. Like, there's tons of caveats with stuff like this. So let's take Buffalo, for example. Voter turnout in Rust Belt cities and off-year elections is really low. And the people that tend to show up for these things are people that have some connections or some stake in the power structure, which in a lot of Rust Belt cities, including the one I live in, is not most people. These elections tend to have one third to half the turnout that even a midterm election has, right? And so we're really talking about a small sliver of the city's population kind of making these decisions. Now, in some of these cities, specifically in Cleveland and a couple of other medium-sized cities, voter turnout was way up, and those were the places where these things succeeded. When voter turnout stayed relatively moderate, in most cases, that's where things lost. Now, Minneapolis, I think, is the exception to this, right? So we have that dynamic to keep in mind. Most people don't participate in these things. And so we're really looking at, in most places, a very small sliver of the population making a decision, and a small sliver of the population that feels connected to the political system. And a lot of those people are pro-police, right? You'd have to be connected to the political system. The second thing to keep in mind with a city like Buffalo is you take Buffalo in the context of the rest of Rust Belt cities, and Buffalo is historically deeply conservative. It's whiter than a lot of other Rust Belt cities, and it's a lot more Catholic than a lot of other Rust Belt cities, right? And so the idea that a socialist was going to become mayor of Buffalo was sort of this like weird anomaly in history, right? Like, they had a socialist mayor like 100 years ago, but so did a lot of Rust Belt cities, right? That's not new. The idea that Buffalo would elect a socialist over a moderate Democrat, when that primary happened, it was almost unbelievable. It was almost a fantasy world. And a lot of people were saying that at the time. What that was, what we saw yesterday in Buffalo, was a return back to their political normality. Like, that is the standard politics of people who actually participate in city politics in Buffalo, is that they tend to be moderate Democrats, right? That's not new. So it's not like there's a huge political shift that happened there, right? The status quo stayed. And that was very likely always going to be true, right? You take Seattle, right? Seattle is a city which is rapidly gentrifying. And even though there was a very militant movement against the police there, a lot of the people that live in Seattle have a lot of things that they think that they need to rely on the police to, quote, protect, right? There's a lot of gentrifiers. There's a lot of yuppies in Seattle. There's a lot of tech companies, right? All of those constituencies tend to be really militantly pro-police. And so it's, again, not a huge surprise that in a citywide election, the progressive lost. I mean, I think a lot of us think of Seattle as this very left-wing city, and there are definitely elements of that there for sure, right? But again, it is a gentrifying city. And if we look at gentrifying cities in general, not just Seattle, but if we look at gentrifying cities in general, as gentrification happens, politics tend to get more moderate. That's generally the trend. And we can see that in New York, right? We can see that in other cities as well. Ted Wheeler in Portland is a good example of this, right? Jacob Frey in Minneapolis is a good example of this, which Minneapolis is a city that's also experienced gentrification. So we can't just think of these things as like neutral indicators, right? We have to think of these things in the context of local politics. And when you think about them that way, all of these results actually make a ton of sense and don't really indicate huge shifts like people think they do.
Well, also it's, you know, the party is turning largely on like these outlier progressive candidates that are, have connections maybe to the DSA or whatever. Like, for instance, you brought up the situation in Buffalo. I'm reading that the person that replaced Andrew Cuomo refused to support them and came, basically gave their blessing to the write-in candidate, the one who won. So, I mean, it's no surprise then that, like, you know, when the establishment where all the money is backs a certain candidate, a lot of people are going to go for that. Apparently, a lot of the major unions in the area back that candidate as well, as opposed to the DSA-backed person, which, again, doesn't surprise me at all because so much of the union leadership, not the rank and file, though, but the union leadership itself, of course, is in bed with the Democratic Party. I mean, this is one of the problems why unions have atrophied and become essentially this either late labor brokeraging firm, something that survives only to collect dues, and also create, you know, a symbiotic relationship with the Democratic Party, which is so, you know, is designed to manage class struggle, keep it in this basically back boardroom thing so it doesn't break out, and essentially manage austerity and the lowering of wages so people don't get out of control.
Yeah, well, and so let's talk about the exception. Like, let's talk about what happened in Cleveland and why that happened that way. There's a lot of things to keep in mind. Cleveland is the poorest major city in America, right? It's also one of the most violent major cities in America. It's also a city which has been dominated by the Democratic Party for generations, and specifically a very moderate wing of the Democratic Party. For a very long time, it's also been a city which is typified by incredibly low levels of political participation. But keep in mind, 7 years ago, the police murdered a 12-year-old in Cleveland. And people have been out in the streets in that city on and off for 7 years now. And when a group of people is out in the streets for that long and they're able to pull, like, I mean, in late May in Cleveland, there were like 5,000 people out in the streets in a city of 450,000, right? And the rioting and the looting there was really intense. And that all is a result of 7 years of organizing work and hard work on the ground and shifts in the sort of discourse there. Those shifts weren't necessarily new positions. Those shifts were that the social movements in the city were able to give voice to positions that people were not otherwise comfortable articulating in public. Because one of the things that typifies a city like Cleveland or Chicago is that politicians and police retaliate. And so in places like that, historically, people are less likely to be honest about what their real political positions are. When social movements break out in places like that, there's often a level of surprise in the media about how militant and how radical they are. Because it doesn't seem like that's what's happening, because when journalists go talk to people, they hear these really moderate things, right? But really on the ground, the reality is very different. And so even there, what happened is not really a surprise at all. You also have to keep in mind that just before this, in that area, there was a primary race for a U.S. House seat because the former House rep for that area, Marsha Fudge, became the leader, the head of HUD under Joe Biden. That House seat has been essentially controlled by Democrats for as long as that House seat has existed, and specifically has a history of relatively progressive Democrats holding that seat. And this time around, the chairwoman of the Cuyahoga County Democratic Party, who's named Chantel Brown, who is now a new U.S. House rep, was able to mobilize a bunch of Republican donors and conservative talking points to win a primary against a socialist candidate, like an openly socialist candidate. If you look at how that vote total broke down, though, and I was looking at this last night, trying to understand what happened there. If you look at the vote totals, though, in the city of Cleveland, the socialist candidate won overwhelmingly. It was the suburbs that pushed the moderate. And so that really is one of these things which is a clear indicator of what was about to happen yesterday, and why it's not a surprise. And so all of these journalists, and God, there's been like 800 editorials about this today, are saying things like, oh, well, everything that happened in the uprising last year is worthless. Everyone chose moderate politics because of danger and violence and so on, so on. There's nothing to indicate that that's true. Literally nothing. If you want to make the claim that 20% of a city is able to express, like, 20% of a city, which is very specifically attached to the political system, feels the ability to express the will of the whole city, then sure, yeah, those people were never down with getting rid of the police to begin with. And so we can't take a bunch of moderate liberals voting for moderate liberals as an indicator that anything has changed. Because in the cities where the voter turnout shifted, those things won. And that's the important indicator, actually. Like, if you really look at a place like Cleveland, where voter turnout was up and the demographics of people that showed up changed, shifted, became poorer and less white, those initiatives won and those candidates won, right? That's the important story here. It's not that defunding the police failed in Seattle and Minneapolis and places like that. There was already pushback there. And those are already areas in which, again, political participation tends to be confined to people that are more moderate. The real indicators is where a change has happened, an actual change has happened. And that has happened on the heels of less wealthy, less white voters showing up and pushing positions that are against the continuation of policing as it exists. That's the important indication.
So what do we make of the claim that the Republicans winning in some areas is basically a reflection of the Democrats, you know, failure to govern, quote unquote, or their inability to pass like the Build Back Better Act, which is, you know, this package of legislation and, you know, investing, quote unquote, in human infrastructure that they've really been pushing and fighting with, not only people in their own party, but also the Republicans. What do we make of that claim?
This is another claim which is incredibly thinly sourced. Really, a lot of this claim centers around three things. First are local school board elections. The second is the gubernatorial election in New Jersey. And the third is the gubernatorial election in Virginia, which is really the one that everyone's focusing on. So let's take school board elections first, because in reality, sure, some random conservatives won school board seats in places that they wouldn't have otherwise won. We have to also keep in mind that a lot of school board seats are open and people don't really run against people. And if people do run against people, they're not really running against known other people. School board elections are always this kind of weird backwater in which fringy political candidates can always gain positions. And the number of roles that they actually gained were incredibly small, given the fact that Steve Bannon was essentially giving them free advertising on his podcast for like 6 months, right? That in a lot of places where they tried to actually really run campaigns hard, they failed. And they failed very specifically in suburbs, which is a really important indication, because again, Trump lost in 2020 by roughly the same margin that suburbanites shifted their votes. And so when the right wing mounts a concerted campaign with funding and AstroTurf organizations and whole news networks like Fox News essentially pushing a certain political line that is sort of in line with that, and they still don't win, that's something that's important. And again, it indicates the opposite of what a lot of these pundits are saying. They're saying, oh, some QAnon people won an, you know, school board seat in a suburb outside of Detroit. I mean, I don't know if it was Detroit, but suburbs outside of cities. You know, okay, cool. There were like two candidates and one barely ran a campaign, or this place has already elected some fringy people, or there's 20 people on the school board and this is one person, right? That is not an indication of a huge political shift. The fact that they failed to win as many seats as they did in suburban areas with all the funding and all the support that they had, that's the indicator. That's the important thing. They were able to swing almost no voters in their direction, none. And in the places where they did win one or two seats in suburbs, if you go and really look at those places, and I kind of did a sample kind of spot check of some of these places around the country that were getting mentioned in news articles, these are usually suburbs which are outer ring suburbs that tend to be wealthier and tend to be more conservative already anyways. So it's not like QAnon people are winning school board seats in city school boards or even entering suburban school boards. They're winning them in far-flung, far-out, already wealthy, mostly white suburbs, which is not a surprise at all. That doesn't change literally anything about the analysis that people have had for the last year. Nothing. It's exact. It literally is a replay of everything that we've been saying, not just us, but like Politico. Even people at Huffington Post, right, have been saying this kind of stuff for a year already. And that doesn't change. So, okay, we can't use that as an indication. We can't use New Jersey as an indication because, you know, literally right before we started recording this, it was announced that the Democrat won. So we can't use that. So all we have left is now Virginia. Virginia is the literal only example that moderate Democrats have to hang this argument on is Virginia. So let's talk about Virginia, because Virginia is a very special place politically. A number of things to keep in mind. First, I want to talk about there's general dynamics in Virginia. Then there's the very specific dynamics of Terry McAuliffe, the Democratic candidate, and his role in the Democratic Party and his role in pushing the Democratic Party to the center over the last 30 years. But to start, Virginia in general is a very politically complicated state. There are a lot of people that live in Virginia that are not citizens of the state, that live in the DC metro area, that maintain temporary residences. There is a lot of money in the northern part of the state, again, the DC metro area. And the DC metro area tends to be very, very liberal, very, very liberal. But then you have the rest of the state. And sure, in Virginia, you've got Richmond, right? Newport News, Charlottesville, right? Like these are liberal outposts and every state has those. But Virginia was also the capital of the Confederacy. And I think a lot of us forget that. Like we look at, you know, Prince George's County right outside DC, or we look at Richmond, which is kind of like hipstery and cool. Or we look at Charlottesville, which is like a liberal college town. And we forget that the rest of the state of Virginia, which is very large, is actually deeply conservative, deeply, deeply conservative, and has been for a long, long time. And so in Virginia, elections are swung by really thin margins a lot of times when they're on a state level. And what that leads to is a really interesting dynamic, which is that politics in Virginia tend to be really tied in with whatever's going on in DC. And that's because of, well, bordering the district. But one of the things that tends to happen in Virginia is when there is a gubernatorial election in Virginia, I forget how long it's been. It's been decades, at least 60 or 70 years. Only one time has the candidate from the party that was in power in Washington won a gubernatorial race in Virginia. Every other time, the opposition party wins. That's a lot of gubernatorial races. If it's 60 years, that's at least 15 of them. And in 14 of them, the opposition party has won. So whatever party's in the White House, the other party wins the governorship in Virginia, the vast majority of the time. So the fact that the Republican won is not that surprising, because that's actually historically what should be expected in Virginia, right? Virginia, again, is deeply, deeply conservative. And yeah, there were a lot of really messed up parts of the Youngkin campaign, the guy who won, specifically around racism. But again, Virginia was the heart of the Confederacy, literally. And it's not entirely surprising that, say, running an entire gubernatorial campaign based on banning critical race theory from schools would work there. I mean, you also have to remember some of the governors of Virginia that they've had in the past are kind of the precursors of kind of Trumpian politics, right? Ken Cuccinelli, for example, who ended up being one of the higher ups at the Department of Homeland Security under Trump, right? So it, again, there is a conservative streak in Virginia that is very almost invisible to a lot of people that live outside of Virginia. I know, like, I live in the north in a Rust Belt city. That's not something I would know or have any awareness of if this wasn't something I followed and studied, right? And so that dynamic is in play. And Trump is in play. And Trump showed up in Virginia to campaign for this guy. And, you know, all this outside money poured in to run ads and all these super PACs showed up. And, you know, for the Republicans, this race was really important. Because for them, they had to win. Not just because of the political history of Virginia, but they had to, in some way, find some race that they could use to make the claim that Joe Biden's agenda is, quote, failing, right? And that everyone knows it, and the country is falling into the pits of hell, right? Which is what you hear on Fox News all the time. They have to prove that somehow. And so winning that gubernatorial race became really important for them, like almost irrationally important for them. So there was a quip, Terry McAuliffe during one of the debates, said something snarky and I forget what it was, but for whatever reason, it became kind of a cause on the right wing. And it was after that, that the Youngkin campaign pulled ahead, that before that McAuliffe was winning. And so again, really thin margins in Virginia, like really, really thin margins. But those thin margins tend to swing in the direction that they swung yesterday. Like, that's not anomalous at all. I forget who it was. I think it was someone in Politico pointed this out. It was a whole article about how the media is way overreacting to what happened in Virginia. That it's not necessarily an indication that Virginians rejected the Biden agenda or something like that, or that they're accepting Trumpism or something. It's really more of, it's more grounded in kind of political history and sort of the political tendencies that have built up in Virginia over the last couple of years. Remember, under the most recent governor, the right wing in Virginia really mobilized hard around gun rights stuff. And there were those massive rallies in Virginia, armed rallies in Virginia, that happened like 3-4 years ago. And I'd actually forgotten about those until about a week ago when I started looking into this campaign specifically. And a lot of the people that were involved in the grassroots organizing around this campaign for the Republicans were people that were involved in organizing those rallies, right? Like, it's not, again, this is not that surprising. Like, it's not surprising. But there's another thing that's in play here. And this is probably the more important thing. And this is actually where I want to focus a lot of attention tonight. We have to talk about who Terry McAuliffe is. So Terry McAuliffe, who was Democratic candidate for governor, had been the governor before, I think 8 years ago or something like that. He was the governor. But before that, Terry McAuliffe was a person that is and was deeply involved in the Democratic Leadership Council. So if people that don't know, the DLC is a faction of the Democratic Party that got built up under Bill Clinton in the early 90s. I mean, some people trace its roots back to the late 80s. But they really kind of consolidated during that period of time. And they made this argument where they said, Americans are getting more conservative. We can see that. They voted for Reagan. They're getting more conservative. So therefore, we need to get more conservative. And, you know, progressive candidates will always lose because Americans are conservative. Okay. I'll get into the problems with that position in a second, but I want to go through the history first. So he comes out of those roots and rose up through the ranks of the Democratic Party, ultimately to become the chairperson of the Democratic Party, by allying himself with the Clintons, very specifically. What that means is that he allied himself with things like cutting social spending, balancing the federal budget, increasing the size of the military, engaging in neoliberal globalization, so on, so on, so on. And that has been his politics ever since. So there's something really odd about this argument that they're making, right? This argument is kind of cropping up, which moderate Democrats are starting to say, well, look, Terry McAuliffe lost. So if he lost, obviously he lost because people are rejecting progressive Democrats, obviously. There is absolutely no foundation for that conclusion. Absolutely none. Like, let's break this argument down a bit. They're trying to say that Terry McAuliffe, who is not only a moderate Democrat, but literally instrumental in creating the faction of moderate Democrats, lost because of progressives. That does not make any sense. So we have to really get into why that happened. Like, let's actually dive into a bit of why McAuliffe lost yesterday, because he was sort of on the way to winning. Not really in an anointed sense, but he very likely was going to win the election. But his campaign, for all intents and purposes, for anyone that all political analysts that kind of were aware of the campaign and maybe in contact with people in the campaign, was horrendously run. It was terrible. They ran the entire campaign about Donald Trump, which, sure, lots of people hate Donald Trump. But that's all they talked about. They said, Glenn Youngkin is Donald Trump, so you shouldn't vote for him because he's Donald Trump. And so he comes out and goes, yeah, but this is where me and Trump differ, because he's at least coming out of not really the super right wing of the Republican Party in Virginia. He's kind of coming out of the middle right. Right. So more conservative than the moderates, but definitely not like originally out of the MAGA crowd. He used to be a hedge fund manager. Right. And so he ran his whole campaign on this idea that he's just a normal suburban dad that's really concerned about politics. And he barely until the very end talked about Terry McAuliffe at all. He was saying, look, I'm just this guy. That guy is a creature of the Democratic Party political machine, which is true. That's not a lie. That is absolutely true. Now, the Youngkin campaign lied about a bunch of other stuff. And about 3 months ago, they got really racist with everything. But at least the claim that Terry McAuliffe is deeply tied in with big business interests and sort of, you know, financial institutions and pharmaceutical companies and things like that is not wrong. He absolutely 1,000% is. And so then we have to start to think about, like, okay, well, what do people in Virginia or nationally even think about progressive policies? Because obviously, if progressive policies are the thing that cost Terry McAuliffe the election, and I'm not, you know, like, I'm not diving into this because that's like a game-changing thing. I'm diving into this because this does say a lot about our political dynamics. If you really dive into progressive policies, like just take the policies that were proposed in the Build Back Better plan, all of which have been shot down by Joe Manchin, very specifically. Those included things like improving roads, universal pre-K, you know, free community college, you know, student loan relief, blah, 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 jobs programs. All of those in every poll done are widely popular. And when I mean widely popular, I mean 60% approval ratings, 60%. What that means is that Trump supporters support those policies, which is not actually all that surprising, because this whole position that moderates lose because of progressives is grounded in one basic fundamental fallacy. And that fundamental fallacy is that Americans are consistent with their politics, right? We have this idea that, you know, moderates, quote, moderates win because most Americans are, quote, moderates, because most Americans are independents. We talked a little bit about this around election time, but it's really interesting in this context. But that's not actually true. If you actually look at Americans' political positions, often they're entirely incoherent. right? They contradict each other a lot of the time. People will say things like, yeah, sure, I'm in support of business, but I really don't like globalization. Or I really support people's ability to make money, but I totally want billionaires.
Time.
C is for
cauliflower,
confusion, creation,
pickle, K is for
kitten,
cam,
seat, wait, fan, roof, seat, U, unbearable,
U is for underground,
oh, yeah,
umbrella,
T, trite,
tremendous,
torment,
tire,
C, K,
I can't think of a U one,
T,
F is for famous,
fun, fumble, M is for Montreal.
Hello, dear listeners. As of March 16th, CKUT Studios will be closed until further notice. The programming on our airwaves will consist of a mixture of recent CKUT archives, new pre-recorded segments, and other relevant special programming. Our upcoming funding drive will be postponed until further notice. Thank you for understanding that we are taking these measures to protect the health of our staff and community members. Love, CKUT.
We've never met, and to be honest, we probably never will. That's not really important. But there are probably people out there who are important to you, who are reluctant to get the COVID-19 vaccine for themselves and for their children. We all have our reasons. But if we take the time to listen to others, we can help reassure and support them. And that's really important.
Salut, ici Matt Track, vous écoutez CKUT 90,3 FM.